is Dr. Will Tuttle, and it's just wonderful to have you with us here on our, I think this is the 45th, third Thursday World Peace Diet Circle call, and it's January 15th, 2015. Wow, a lot of 15s there. So, Madeline and I just arrived in Austin today. We're on our 77-day lecture tour, and it's so far going really very well. I want to thank all of you for joining us, and this is exciting, actually. So we're in our RV again. We're back in our rolling home after 17 years living in this rolling home. And then about the last 2 years, we've been in a house in Northern California, so it's a very pleasant experience, actually. It's nice to see the outside view out our window changing all the time. We're parked right now in front of a house that's owned by Rip Esselstyn in Austin. He's not here, and I guess he's traveling, and I think this is a house perhaps that he rents out. I'm not sure exactly the story. But anyway, we're here, and it's right by a little stream where Madeline and I took a little dip earlier today after we arrived here. And the water was really gray. I felt good after driving from San Antonio, where we gave a lecture last night. And so, as you all know, if you've been on the call before, usually at the beginning of the call, we like to take just a couple of minutes and focus our attention within. So if you're driving your car right now or something else, keep your eyes open and your eyes on the road and so forth. But if not, if you'd like to perhaps turn your attention within, and perhaps we can take a moment and give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have to connect together as we do once every month. Those of us who are part of this World Peace Diet Circle and feel our connection with each other through the affirmation and through the inspiration and the yearning that we have to more deeply understand the truth that we are, to more skillfully be able to bring the message of vegan living, kindness and compassion for all living beings into our world, to become more effective in our advocacy, to live our lives with joy and authenticity. We give thanks for the example that we are able to see in each other and and so many other people. We give thanks for everyone who is working to bring this vision of a world at peace and harmony with justice and freedom. And we give thanks, of course, to all the non-human animals whose lives are such a mysterious miracle to us, really. I think how they suffer at our hands, how they celebrate with abandon, their enormous powers and potentials, the subjects of their lives as we are. And may we, as human beings, learn to find our right relationship with the earth, with animals, and with each other. And we give thanks finally knowing that we are part of an awakening on this planet of human consciousness, so that we can truly celebrate our lives in harmony with our true nature, that we can come home to the wisdom in our hearts and the compassion that is our true nature as human beings, that we may no longer allow our lives to be hijacked by the herding culture of domination and exploitation of other living beings. Through the deep yearning of our hearts, we know that our goal is absolutely guaranteed, and in time, timeless time, in the eternal time, hopefully before too long, the illusion of violence that we see enacting out or all around us will be dispelled. So it is. All right, so I say it's an illusion. I know it's certainly not an illusion if you're going through it. So many animals are. So I'll just say here at the beginning, as those of you who are maybe here for the first time, that this is typically lasts somewhere between an hour and an hour and a half. We're in Central Time, so 8 to 9 here, wherever you happen to be. Some people call in from all over North America and occasionally from other parts of the world. And it is fine. This is really your opportunity to not only listen to what I'm saying and other people are saying, maybe sharing over the next hour, but also to say something yourself. You're always welcome to do that. And just remember, press star 7, I believe, to unmute your phone, and then I'll see it here, and I'll be able to to actually raise your hand, and then I'll be able to unmute you. If you want to type in a question, I'd like to start doing that again. Just send an email to willtuttle@earthlink.net, and I will I'll check that now and then throughout the hour, next hour and a half, so that if you if you want to leave and ask a question, you can do it that way. Great. All right. So we have quite a bit of news here on our end I'd like to share. And again, as I said, if you have comments or questions, feel free to jump in at any point here. So Madeline and I guess for us the big news really is that we're doing our first major lecture tour in a year. And we've done lots of smaller ones for a few weeks or so. Of course, the last big one we did about a year ago to Taiwan, Australia, and New Zealand, that was a major effort. This one also is, because we're doing so many events and it's for a longer period of time, I'm not sure how many we're doing exactly, but it keeps increasing. And it's going to end up averaging probably close to one per day over the 77 days, so probably close to 60 or so, or 70 events, and because some days we do a couple. And it's a lot of driving, quite a bit of traveling, too. And it's just great, though. We really enjoy connecting with people in the flesh, as they say. It's one thing to do things online or like this, through telephone and to sharing ideas this way. And it's, again, quite another thing to have the opportunity to talk to each other, answer questions, and see people. And we already had some just terrific opportunities just in the last week and a half or so down in Southern California in Orange County at the Loving Hut there. And then we went across to Tucson. It was an excellent event in Tucson, the Unitarian Church. I think there was close to 150 people at that event. And then we went from there on to Las Cruces and El Paso and had events there. And then from there, just recently, to San Antonio last night, actually. And then tomorrow night in Austin. And then from there, we have two events in Houston and on to New Orleans, Pensacola, Tallahassee, Melbourne, Orlando, and quite a few, Gainesville, all over Florida, actually, probably. I think we've pretty much saturated Florida. The only place we're not really hitting directly is Miami, but we're pretty close in West Palm Beach. And so, but we've got lots of events in Florida, and then coming back again through Arizona and Southern California, and up into Central California in March. So it's great to be able to talk to people directly and answer questions directly. A couple of the questions I wanted to maybe address that I've heard recently and maybe share a little bit about them. And again, as I said, if you have any further comments or questions, please let me know. We had a question last night, and this, it seems to come up quite a bit. One is, you know, it seems like there are still so many people who just don't get it. And what can we do to ramp up our efforts and be more effective to really make this happen? You know, that seems to be an ongoing question that people have. You know, we vegans are still only 1 or 2% of the population. Time's running so short. What can we do to just, we have to do something. It's like this sense of panic almost. We've got to do something. We've got to reach the people. What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And so, again, I think that's definitely a valid question. And some people, of course, have been talking about the importance of reaching the religious leaders, because it seems that we can, you know, pretty much all social justice movements have succeeded or been able to at least make progress, I guess. You know, none of them have really succeeded at this point, but they made some significant progress, and only made significant progress when they were able to get the religious leaders on board and get religion more involved in this. And I think there's an element of truth in that, and quite a few people have asked me if I would sort of, I don't like using the word spearhead, it sounds so masculine, but spearhead the effort. Funny. But, you know, sort of somehow try to make an effort to bring veganism into the religions of the world, and especially Christianity, of course, in the United States. And, of course, that's a lot easier said than done. It seems that in many ways religion is really the one of the main obstacles, because it's so permeated with this idea of human supremacy, and that animals are either irrelevant or they're almost part of the problem. You know, there's this sense of the animal nature is it's what we have to fight, fight and conquer. And this is very deeply embedded, that animals are just stupid, lustful, greedy. You know, all the negative qualities in ourselves we project onto animals. And religious, I see this a lot in so-called religious writings, the swinish elements, or all these names that that are used for negative human qualities. They are projected onto animals, and so it's very difficult. I'm really grateful, actually, Christine, one of our, and John McLaren from Victoria, gifted me with a book that goes even more deeply into what Jesus was actually teaching. And I talk about this quite a bit in the World Peace Diet in one section. I mean, not a whole lot, but I devote a couple of pages to Keith Akers' book, The Lost Religion of Jesus. And I think he actually built on the work of this book, The Origin of Christianity by Charles Vaclavic, that I've been reading. I'm almost finished with this book. I just read a little bit every day in the morning. And I think it's just, I highly recommend it, actually. I think if you want to read a book that will kind of explain, perhaps, I mean, I don't know if anything is completely, we know if it's true or not, but I think he does an excellent job of explaining exactly how Christianity veered away completely in the opposite direction of what the original Jesus and his original disciples or followers were emphasizing, and using source texts that go back to the very earliest days, right after Jesus and his disciples were teaching. It's quite fascinating to see that their three main things that they emphasized in their teachings were compassion for animals, not eating them, not wearing them. They were known to be vegetarian. Of course, that word wasn't present then, but they did never ate meat, they never drank wine, and they never wore wool. They only wore cotton linen. And so they were really opposed to violence towards animals. They refused, of course, to own slaves. They refused to go to war, and they were radical pacifists. They refused to fight back if they were attacked. And it's very interesting to read Charles Vaclavic's he goes into it really in depth, how they would get beaten up and they wouldn't fight back. And also communalism, that they've tried not to own personal property. They try to own everything together and share everything together. That they were basically products of Pythagoreanism highly influenced by Pythagoras. And that the Essenes were probably Essenes as well. Essenes and Nazarenes were and another group called the Therapeutae. But anyway, they were all vegetarian. None of them ate meat and dairy. And they really disbelieved in some of the books of the Old Testament. They were Jewish. They were all Jewish. But they said that some of the books of the Old Testament had been tampered with. The parts of the Old Testament where the Lord God is shown to delight in animal sacrifices or tells people to go slaughter everyone in the city. You know, he said, you know, their God, they said, would never do that. Their God did not want animals to be killed. Their God did not want people going to war. They said that some parts of the Old Testament had really been messed with. And that was what Jesus was teaching, apparently, that part of the Old Testament was so-called, you know, the law. Of course, they didn't call it the Old Testament back then, but had been tampered with in order to justify certain behaviors and allow the priests to get rich and make money off of animal sacrificing and to promote war, but that was not part of the original Old Testament writings. And so they were not very well liked by some of the basic Jewish people. They were very radical, and of course Jesus went in and turned over the tables and really caused mayhem. Because not because of the money change, but because he hated to see the violence towards animals. And there's quite a lot of peripheral material that Charles Vaclavic brings in that actually shows other writers talking about this from the earliest days. So anyway, it's very interesting to see. And then I won't give the whole plot away, but it's quite convoluted. But the basic idea in a nutshell is that these original Judaic Christians, after Jesus was crucified, they continued on, of course. He makes a very interesting point that Jesus was crucified, but actually not killed, because he wasn't on the cross that long. So he wasn't actually not killed. He was severely wounded and then came out of he talks about this in a footnote, but this is something, anyway, so that's very interesting. And then he was thought to be resurrected by some people. But usually they were crucified they usually didn't die for, you know, 2 or 3 days. It took a long time. And he was taken down after only something like 12 or 14 hours. But anyway, so, there were two other groups, that kind of followed on. One was led by Paul, and they were Gnostics, the Gnostic Christians led by Paul. And, they had a whole different teaching, you know, this sort of that Jesus is the Son of God, and that you just have to believe that, and you'll be saved from, you'll have eternal life. That idea, that's a Gnostic idea that Paul brought in, and then he has his other idea, which I thought is very interesting, that the beloved disciple John actually was a Jewish priest, and that he's really the one that created the Catholic Church. He's the one that created the Eucharist. They were no longer allowed, after the temple got destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, they couldn't do any animal sacrifices anymore. So that really is what they were fighting against, was animal sacrifices. But after the Romans destroyed the temple in 70 AD, there were no more animal sacrifices. And John, the beloved disciple, was sent to Patmos, part of that, to prison, but then he was freed, and he lived to be an old, very old man into his late 90s. And he's the one that, according to Vaclavic, as he kind of puts things together, who created this priestly religion with priests, with communion, with the Eucharist. It was just water and bread, of course, in the beginning, but then after a while it was water mixed with wine, and then eventually it was just pure wine. And then a few hundred years later, as the priests, so there was, these three were competing, these three versions. There was John, the beloved disciple's priestly Christianity with the Eucharist, And then there was Paul's Christianity, which was the only begotten Son of the Lord, and you believe in him, you'll have eternal life kind of thing. And then there was the original Christians who were very demanding, you know, to know me, vegan, basically, communalism, pacifism. But what Jesus taught was a very demanding religion. And that eventually those three, the original disciples of Jesus were decided, they were condemned as being heretics by the Catholics. And then when Constantine gave the total power to the Catholics a couple hundred years later, they kind of brought some of Paul's teachings in, and then they added 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, which were actually not written by Paul at all, but they were written to kind of, said to be written by Paul, but to actually correct some of Paul's teachings that they didn't like. And so, that is the religion that basically became Christianity, and it's completely the opposite, really, in many ways, of what Jesus taught. There's a little bit in there, of course, what Jesus taught, but for the most part, it's very, very different. And it's been, in his view, and I think it's hard to argue with him, it's been pretty disastrous for, in many ways, in the sense that there's been, you know, these terrible crusades that slaughtered so many people, inspired by Christianity, as well as, many other things like the Inquisition, and then the slave trade, and the killing of all the American Indians, and many wars, and so forth. All things that Jesus and the original disciples were completely opposed to these kinds of behaviors. Slaveholding, of course, was put into Paul's letters. That's totally fine. And if you read this book, it's long. I mean, it's a good 500 pages. But step by step, he kind of shows the what can happen with religion when you have this. You know, someone starting a religion, I don't think he was trying to start a religion, but you know, the people that were living in a certain way that was very, very admirable as vegans, pacifists, communalists, very, very, very pure, just, noble way of living. Almost the opposite, where now, if you, it's almost considered unchristian in some places to refrain from eating meat. And so I think, given that the fact that these kinds of things should happen, in my experience, of course, I've talked about in Unity and what we see in Buddhism as well, where these are all clearly instances of a situation where people were inspired to be vegan, and then with their later followers turned it all around. So for us, I think today to work, if we're going to work within, either work within the religion and try to help them remember to come back to the original teachings, or in a sense create new traditions of spirituality where we are quiet. To me, spirituality is getting beyond the official stories of our culture that we're fundamentally separate, and seeing the interconnectedness of all life, and connecting more deeply with the transpersonal dimension, which is the eternal dimension of consciousness that is the source of what we are, and connecting with that authentically so that we're not only being driven in our life by our conditioning and our thinking and our habits and all of that, but that we're actually being inspired by the transpersonal dimension, which is eternal dimension of consciousness. And I think that kind of what I'm talking about is not really understood in our societies, not recognized as being valid in the kind of materialist society that we live in. But if we look into any other society in the world, I think people recognize this for the most part, and especially in the Buddhist traditions and many of the other Eastern religions traditions, as well as the Western ones, actually. But I think the whole idea is that we are far greater than just this one little confined expression of life, although this one being that we are is enormously important, and that everything we do is very important. So It's great to see, actually, the enrichment, I think, of the vegan movement in the United States and really, I think, in the world today with spirituality. I think it's happening more and more. You know, Lisa Levinson, I don't know if you know, Lisa, but she's kind of consciously working with the idea of vegan spirituality. Judy Carman and I and Madeline, of course, have the Worldwide Prayer Circle for Animals, which the whole idea behind that is that we can certainly help animals a lot and help the situation of violence towards animals a lot by outer work, by writing letters, by writing books, by having discussion groups, by talking to each other, by sharing ideas. You know, all these things are definitely helpful, all these outer activities and whatever else, you know, direct action, whatever you feel drawn to. But that there's also, as Gandhi emphasized and many other people have emphasized, that working on the inner levels with consciousness so that we actually create a field of awareness where we see compassion as a living, vital force surrounding the earth and embracing all living beings and permeating the consciousness of everyone, where we affirmatively understand that this is the deeper level, this is really the truth that we are beyond the surface level. So I think a lot of the difficulties that we have in the movement in general and in our society in general is that we tend to have a difficult time just because of our upbringing to look beyond the surface level. The reason people, of course, eat meat and dairy is that they can't look beyond the surface. You know, they're sitting there eating bacon, and to them it's just bacon. They just stay on the very surface. It's just eggs. It's just chicken. And if they start looking deeply and see the being there and look into the subject, it's very traumatic. So we all learn in our society not to do that. So even after we go vegan, I think we still have the tendency not to look deeply, just because it's been, you know, hammered into us from the time we're little infants, not to do that. So I think when we go vegans, it's very important for us to continue our quest to look more and more deeply into the nature of being that we are, and to do that as authentically as we can through our own inner work. Maybe I'll talk about that a little bit more actually here in a few minutes. But so anyway, that's one thing that's been coming up, this question of how we can be more effective, how can we work with religion. I think working with organized religion, of course, is always somewhat problematic, but I think the more we can bring the vegan message into our churches and synagogues, you know, that's great, because those are the repositories of ethical behavior in our society, really, of the religious institutions. So if we can, I read somebody won a contest or something in a local church recently where they're prize was, whoever won the contest was that their prize would be that they would get to determine 1 week what the topic of the sermon would be. And so this guy who happened to win said, okay, I want the topic to be veganism. And he was a Unitarian church, so he got his minister to, had to, against his will, in a sense, he had to make a sermon on veganism. I have to listen to it. I heard it's pretty good, actually. But I mean, there's all kinds of ways that we can somehow perhaps bring this in. We can also of course, always do the best we can if we're in religion, whatever religious institution we're in, to see what we can do to have a world peace diet study group, for example, or to have cooking classes also in our communities. But I think bringing things into the religions of the world, some people talk about, you know, efforts to make famous people like the Dalai Lama or Pope or somebody to go vegan or to at least talk more about it. And those are good ideas, I think, although we have to remember that these influential people are up against, they have enormous pressure against them. I saw that very directly myself, one-on-one with the Dalai Lama. He's surrounded by a lot of senior monks who would absolutely be fit to be tied if he started talking about the importance of monks being vegan or Buddhists being vegan or even vegetarian. And I'm sure the same is true with the Pope, but they are forced to do it, and the Dalai Lama has been forced quite a bit to do that because of younger Buddhists, for example, really demanding that he do that, and other people too. So The more I think we go vegan, the more the grassroots movement grows, the more the celebrity people, whoever they are, the more well-known people will, if they're inclined, which hopefully they are, people like James Cameron, of course, it's so great to see, these people really having a strong influence and yearning to bring veganism, and they'll feel more supported in doing that, that they're not just doing something that's completely unpopular. So that's one aspect. Another aspect I wanted to touch on was one of our people who's going through the program right now, Susan from Sedona, asked me, and I wanted to this is something that comes up from time to time, actually, and variations of this question I hear quite a bit too when we give our lectures, that the spirit, that there are certain spiritual objections to veganism. The people have this idea that if they become more evolved spiritually, then rules, and veganism is seen as a rule, you don't have to follow rules anymore because you're spiritual, that following certain rules of living are only for less evolved people, less spiritual people. They need rules. But those of us who are more evolved, we don't need to have these rules. We can eat whatever we want. We can say whatever we want because we are more spiritual. And it's actually very interesting. In this book by Charles Vakovic, it's called The Origin of Christianity, that I was talking about, this was an explicit teaching of the Gnostics, actually, and they believe that they were the chosen ones. That this whole idea of certain people being the chosen ones, I think, is a little bit problematic, but that as Gnostics, they knew directly they had some sort of this direct knowing of God, and that's what Gnostic means. It means knowing. And so because of that, they could really not do anything wrong, that they were guaranteed to have eternal life in heaven. And you hear this quite a bit in Christianity, because when Protestant Christianity came along, which is similar to, in many ways, according to Vakovic, and I think he's right about this, that was really bringing back, Martin Luther was really kind of bringing back Paul. Really strongly, bringing Paul back in. And I know I was raised in a Protestant church, and Paul is more important than Jesus very often. And this idea that, like what Paul said, was that just your faith, just your belief alone that Jesus died for your sins, that you will have eternal life because he is God, he's the Son of God, that kind of idea. That's an ancient Gnostic idea. That you don't really have to worry, and that's a real problem, I think. A lot of people think, well, I don't have to show compassion to animals. I don't have to do that. I mean, because, I'm guaranteed to go to heaven. I'm guaranteed. It's all set, and this old Gnostic idea. It's interesting to see that, actually, James, like in the book of James, it's just the opposite. James was the brother of Jesus, and he said, faith without works is dead. This idea that you've got to live it. Actually, and that's what Jesus said. I think this is what the Buddha said. This is what all the great spiritual teachers actually said. They did not talk about, this idea that you can do whatever you want if your consciousness is pure, I guess. That idea is there in certain traditions, but that's a teaching that's not meant for people who aren't ready for it. And like, for example, when I was in Korea, that teaching was there for us as monks, that if you meditate really intensively, we were sitting for 3 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and some people would go even longer every day, and you get to a certain state of consciousness where you know directly the truth that you're not just separate self. And when that sense of separate self falls away, then we see directly that we're not separate from other beings. So the idea of harming another for my own benefit is just ludicrous. It's absurd. There's this natural sense of wanting others to be happy and not wanting to have something for myself that would maybe reduce their happiness. That's a natural kind of a thing. I remember, I don't know if I've ever told this story, but I remember I was, I was there for all these months in this monastery, and it was pretty much all Koreans. There was like three or four of us Caucasians, one guy from Denmark, two guys from England, and me. And and one guy from Germany. And so they would sometimes, the lay people would sometimes give us Westerners a gift. They'd kind of feel sorry for us because all we ever had to eat was just rice and vegetables. You know, that was it. It was rice and vegetables and a little tofu. They called tubu in Korean. And it was pretty much just breakfast and lunch. There was no dinner. And so basically, I didn't really mind, but I know especially this guy from Denmark, there was some of them, they really missed having some bread and having something, you know, that they were more used to. And every once in a while, somebody would make a gift of some cakes, you know, to us. And so, and actually to all the monks, to the foreign Sangha. And so, I remember this one time everybody got one of these little cakes, like this little cake, and so some of the monks, it was in the afternoon, I think some of them ate it, some of them, you know, a few people, some of them saved it, and everybody, we all had our own little locker, it was our own private locker, like a little wooden place you could put things, and so I just put mine in my locker, maybe have it tomorrow or something, so I put it in there, and then I came back the next day to get my little cake, and it was gone. Some other monk had taken my cake and eaten it. And so the reason it was interesting, I was meditating every day, and I was doing the four Viharas every day, what I remember is that I just, when I saw that, I didn't have any sense of being upset. I just didn't have any, it didn't even occur to me to be upset. It was like, oh, that's neat. You know, one of the other monks, you know, somebody got to have two, you know. And I just tuned into this guy that ate one and then ate another one, you know, and thought, oh, that must have been really fun to eat one and then eat a whole other one. And I enjoyed his enjoyment, I think, more than I would have enjoyed my own enjoyment of it. And I wasn't trying to. That's just what naturally happened. It was just sort of, you know, you're meditating that many hours a day, I guess, you know, these kind of things can happen. And I just felt that sense. So I think there is, certainly a place where, you know, I didn't have to repress my resentment toward him and get over it. It was just great. I just loved it. It was fantastic, you know. But I think, you know, we all know what that's like. You know, we just spontaneously feel happiness when someone else has something that they can enjoy. And so, this is the foundation, but the basic thing is when people are harming other beings and using as an excuse some kind of spiritual, any kind of spiritual reasoning, I think it's very, very, it's very suspect. But the question, of course, that Susan asked is, okay, well, what do we actually say to these people? She says here in her question, that some of the ways that people articulate this is they'll say, it's all perfect, we're all one, so when I kill the insect in the garden or to eat the chicken, I'm one with it and it's all fine. Or, the animals told me it's okay that we eat them. Or, thought creates reality, it's all just thought. Or, you create your world, Susan, as though this was all in my imagination or dream. Or simply, the world is a dream. All of these seem to hold the implicit message that it doesn't really matter, that it's all just illusion or imagination or God's play. This is what she says. So her idea is, you know, what's the best way to respond to these kinds of ideas? And what is actually, are these wrong views? I would say they are really, really wrong views. And, you know, when we were, for example, as monks in this monastery and doing all this, we had to actually say every 2 weeks about, I can't remember the number, I think it was like 247 vows, all of ethical behavior, you know. That's the underlying foundation. And, of course, you can simplify those down to maybe like in Buddhism, there's the 10 precepts. And we do the best we can to live our lives without killing, stealing, lying, committing sexual misconduct, and forcing others to use liquors or drugs, and, you know, the five basic precepts, and there's five more. But basically, the idea is, I think, really well summed up in the basic teaching that comes, I think, not only from all the traditions in Buddhism, but I remember one articulation of it in the Tibetan tradition goes like this. When your view becomes vast like the sky, then your attention to your behavior becomes fine like flour. And I just think that sums it up really well. You know, the idea is that the more awake we become, the more enlightened, spiritually enlightened we become, the more aware of the interconnectedness of all life, of the infinite beauty of all life, of the infinite sacredness of all life, that does not make us less caring about how we treat others. We do not then get this cavalier kind of feeling like, well, now I'm really enlightened. I can just, you know, kill an animal here and shame somebody over there and bully somebody over there and eat my meat whenever I want. That is really a big tip-off. If someone is masquerading as a spiritual teacher and is acting these ways, be very careful. Because in the West, there are spiritual teachers that do that, unfortunately, who kind of have this kind of way about them that it doesn't really matter what we do to others. And the ancient teachings, I think, are really very clear about this, that if it's an authentic awakening, then the heart of compassion is authentically opened, and we become very sensitive to how and what we're doing that might harm others. And we're very careful not to do that, not only because we are aware that this is a violation that is, you know, we get very sensitive to it, and that it's really very bad for them and for really for ourselves as well. And so I think we can see very clearly that when people do not have this kind of exalted or more wise spiritual view, that they are very easily have this kind of cavalier attitude. You know, you see it all the time. People hit other people like it's no big deal. I mean, they, you know, get in fights and they cheat and lie and steal, and they don't think it's that big of a deal. So if someone who has this eat and dairy and eggs, you know, they think it's no big deal. These animals don't matter. So really, you know, anyone who uses spirituality or any kind of idea that this is a dream, so what we do doesn't matter is clearly displaying gross misunderstanding of the nature of the spiritual teachings and of the nature of reality. And the question is, what do I say to them? You know, how do we respond to that? And I think the only thing we can do really is to just initially agree. I just want to keep emphasizing that. Initially agree with people rather than arguing with them and say, yeah, I know what you mean, you know, and then start using I statements immediately. You know, I used to think the same thing. I used to think that if, you know, when I really evolved spiritually and psychologically to a certain point, that then I could thank the animals, and that was enough because my spirit connected with them, and so even if I killed them or had somebody kill them and ate and eat them, and thanking them, it was all okay. You know, people get a feeling that you understand where they're coming from, but then be very, you know, then talk about my own experience. And I realized that these beings are the subjects of their lives just like I am, that they are capable of feeling pain and fear and do not want to be stabbed and do not want to have their baby stolen, do not want to be raped, do not want to... It causes them tremendous suffering on many different levels, just like it would for me, actually. And these are beings whose suffering is as significant to them as my suffering is to me. And then I realized, and just talk about, you know, my own experience. So then I realized that I could actually eat a plant-based diet and not cause suffering to other living beings, and that this has really been the teaching for thousands of years from spiritual teachers to minimize violence, that violence is the knot of bondage, as many great spiritual teachers have said, that as soon as we harm others for our own benefit, this is a universal spiritual teaching that comes from the most enlightened of all spiritual teachers, all of them, have emphasized this idea that the founder of the Jains, the founder of the Buddhists, the founder of most of the Hindu religions and Christianity, great sages of all the world religions have emphasized these ideas of kindness and compassion and not harming others. As we sow, so shall we reap. You know, this basic idea that when we harm others, we contract ourselves. So just, you know, talking, but just use I sentences. You know, then I realize that when I harm others, it actually creates a certain mental armor, and it puts a ceiling on our spiritual evolution. I think it's absolutely inevitable that on a certain level we cannot evolve beyond the level of our behavior. If our behavior is not in alignment with the truth that we are here to bless others, then we will not be able to go deeper in our meditation. And I think that's, you know, for example, the reason why at Sanlongsa Zen Monastery where I practice, people have been practicing veganism for 750 years, because this was an understanding. And if there, I know there are places where people do meditation and they eat meat. I would say that that is unfortunate. And hopefully we will see these things changing. And I've seen them change. I remember when I was first going to some of Thich Nhat Hanh's events, you know, they ate a lot of dairy. They didn't eat meat. You know, I give them credit for that. But they did eat a lot of dairy if they're on the retreats. And then they changed. And they said, no, we're not going to eat dairy anymore on these retreats. In fact, no monks are allowed to eat dairy at all anymore in his tradition. And I see, you know, people moving in this direction a lot. The Tibetan Buddhists have moved in that direction. The Jains are moving in that direction. Some of the Christians are moving in that direction. So this is the way it has to go, I think. This is the direction of evolution. But it's really, I think, helpful to remember that people who are saying these things are very well supported in our society by all the institutions in our society, by other religious teachers. You know, the Pope is eating meat. You know, so just to use our own I statements, I learned and I tried, and I now, as for me as a vegan, I feel so much less stress about the violence towards animals. I'm not causing it. I mean, it bothers me that this is happening, but I feel more open. I feel more connected. And whatever it is, I mean, just the usual experience. But I know for myself, it's just, it creates this wonderful foundation of spiritual clarity and a sense of kind of, you know, there's a sense. It's so funny, actually. Madeline and I have these little Zen cards that we draw every once in a while, and the two cards we drew for today, right after supper, one was clarity. I drew that one, and she drew obedience. And she seems to all draw this. I mean, it's like 60 cards, and she seems to draw that one very often. And I think it's for both of us, actually, because obedience always seems like not a very good one. Like, what's obedience? But really, I think there is a positive sense to obedience. It's obeying or allowing ourselves to be humble enough to live our lives in accordance with the Dharma, which in the Buddhist tradition is the way it is. You know, the way it is. The way it is we are all interconnected. If we cause suffering to others for our own benefit, it's going to come back. We're shutting down our natural wisdom and compassion, and we're taught to do that in our society. So obedience to the higher laws and allowing ourselves to serve those, no matter what our ego wants to do, I think ultimately brings enormous positive results, enormous rewards. So I hope that's helpful, Susan. And these are my thoughts on that. I think when you say, the other thing you said in this is that these people act so confident, so happy, that it makes you somewhat doubtful, you know, because they're so happy, they're so confident, you know, I mean, it must be right, right? Well, you know, that's, again, that's a very interesting, I won't even begin to, you know, I would say that really, I mean, you know, it's easy to project all kinds of things, but ultimately, as we treat others, and especially those who are vulnerable in our hands, we will create within ourselves a vibratory, an energetic field that corresponds with that. So if we numb ourselves and harm others and go along with our society in harming others, it's just extremely unfortunate, and it holds everybody back. You know, people look back on Thomas Jefferson or other people, you know, their own slaves. I mean, we wish that they hadn't done it. I'm sure they wish that they hadn't have done it now. If they could go back and see the abuse that they inflicted on these people and how it was not really in alignment with their own values, but they were born into such a system. You know, they were born into it. So for us today to realize that most people, all of us are born into it, and it's really relatively few of us are able to, at this point, to question it, but more and more people are, and to be able to always plant seeds. So don't let people get away with this. I mean, if someone says something like this, the animals told me it's okay to eat them, I would really say don't just smile and say, okay, yeah. Don't let them get away with it. Don't just smile and say, okay. Now say, wait a minute, I want to talk about that, and offer another perspective to them in a loving way. But just say, I used to think the same thing. You have to argue, but say, I know what you mean. I used to think the same thing, but then I began to realize that this is actually the official story of our culture. This is what I was taught to think. This is the underlying basic idea that animals are much less important than we are. And they're just here for us to use, and it's very similar to other situations where others have been dominated, black people and women and so forth. It's people of color. I mean, it's the same thing. It's speciesism. What I actually call in my new article, I refer to it as herderism. And so anyway, I think to be vigilant and not let these things pass unchallenged is, I think, very important. Okay, so thank you all. I just wanted to emphasize those main points here. And again, as I was saying, if you have any questions or comments, please press *7. And let me see, what else? Another thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, actually, is the new article that I wrote on herderism, and I forgot to put that up on the resources for the World Peace Diet Circle that you should all be able to see. So, but it is up there now. I just want to let you know it's up there now. I just, right before the call, I realized it and I put it up. So if you go back to, when you're online, if you go to the page, it's worldpeacemastery.com/circle/conference.html. That page that has every single MP3 audio file, the recording of every third Thursday call, and also all of the resources going all the way back to 2011. That page now has the correct one up there, so you can get that down. And if you want to you can click on the link and read it. But the basic idea in the essay is that it's not an idea that's new to most of you, but I thought that, there are these two words that I think are excellent. Speciesism as a word like racism and sexism and so forth. And then the other word that's more recently coined by Melanie Joy of carnism, both of these are talking about a mentality where it's sort of an invisible mentality. This is people who are racist never thought of themselves as being racist. They just thought, we're white, we're superior, that's just how it is, And then later as we evolve, we can begin to see, well, wait a minute, that's actually a violent ideology that harms others. And the same thing with sexism, and the same thing with the word speciesism that was coined a while back, I think in the 60s, by Richard Rider, actually in 1970. But both of those words, speciesism and carnism, I think they're great words in a lot of ways, but they don't actually, they don't give the reason why. So I thought a word herderism, in a way is better because it actually, it talks about this mentality of humans being superior to animals, and the reason is we're born into a herding culture. And so people who live in a herding culture are raised eating and using animals, and just as little boys and girls raised maybe on a plantation in the 1830s are raised with, you know, seeing black people all around them as merely as slaves. So they can't help, I don't think, really, but be racist. You know, they just see these people as property all the time around them. And we see ourselves, we're eating chickens and pigs and cows and raised to do that. So we're raised in a herding society where we herd animals. So we are all essentially injected with this mentality of herderism where we see these animals merely as things to be used. And so what veganism is essentially is the opposite of herderism. The word coined by Donald Watson, where he said this is a completely other way of looking at the world, where we just do not make a concerted effort not to cause any harm to animals for any reason, for food, clothing, or any other purpose. And obviously instead we treat them with kindness and respect and try to use products that don't require any animals to suffer. And so the foundation of this is the ancient teaching of ahimsa, which is of nonviolence, which is the foundation also, I think, of all of kindness and compassion for all living beings. And it's really the root of the social justice movements that we have, I think, is ahimsa. And we talk about this actually in the new book that's just came out called Circles of Compassion, Connecting Issues of Justice. I'm not sure how many of you have a copy of the book, but it's really fun to be selling this book now. We have another book on the table besides World Peace Diet. Although the World Peace Diet is really obviously the book that I wrote. There were Circles of Compassion I edited, and there's a lot of great essays in there by other people. And the basic ideas, I think, in the Circles of Compassion book are all coming out of the World Peace Diet, in the sense that the World Peace Diet is based on seeing our routine abuse of animals for food and other products as the foundational practice and mentality that leads inevitably to racism and sexism and heterosexism and classism and hunger and poverty and abuse of other living beings and other human beings. And that if we don't get to the root of it by going vegan and stopping the mentality of violence towards animals, then we'll never be effective in stopping war and injustice of various kinds in the human world. So it's been great to see after this book, Circles of Compassion, sold out its first printing already, and it's going into its second printing, and doing very well. And I highly recommend it if you'd like to get it. But again, it's very different. It's 30 different people. They're all vegans, actually, who are writing about various aspects of social injustice as it relates to the mentality of violence towards animals. So they all do it in different ways, but it's, you know, the feedback I've been getting anyway from people on it is that they're finding it to be a very helpful book too. So, so let's see here. that's the article I wrote on herderism, the basic idea of pastoralism, the idea that it's sort of this very benign situation where you have the shepherds taking care of the sheep, and it's very bucolic and harmonious and peaceful. It's just sort of the way we should be living. Everybody has a few animals. Now, the sense of animal agriculture being benign and harmonious and cultivating, you know, compassion, that the farmer always cares about his animals. This is really very quite deeply embedded, I think, in the mythology of our society. And so it's the same thing that was, in the South, that the idea of the loving slave master, the loving master who takes care of his slaves and feeds them well, and they have a better life than they'd ever have if they had freedom. That would probably wouldn't know what to do with that. So there's this this real underlying violence and the mentality, actually, of herderism and pastoralism, speciesism, cognism, and we see that in all of these. Whenever there's a sense of entitlement, or certain people think that they have a superior position, we see this kind of thing happening. So what I'm trying to do essentially is awaken the people in our society, vegans also, because a lot of vegans don't understand this. A lot of vegans think, well, you know, we have this violence towards animals, we're going to stop it. And they don't realize that we are in a herding culture, and we have to realize that, like, it's a context for what we're doing, and to move away from that so that we're actually creating a whole different foundation for our society where we're growing plants to eat, and we're no longer imprisoning animals, and it puts us in a completely different relationship with each other and with the earth and with wildlife, all animals. And this is the real challenge of veganism. It's challenging everything at the deepest level, but not in a way, I mean, in a way to destroy it, of course. You know, the aim of veganism is to destroy animal agriculture. This is the aim of liberation, is to destroy slavery, of course. We want to destroy animal agriculture. It's the most devastating, trauma-inducing activity that human beings engage in. But the idea is that we're focusing on creating a harmonious way of living, and that means eating plant-based foods, obviously, not using animal-based products for anything, if we can possibly avoid it, which I think we absolutely have to. And actually, another question I just want to touch on briefly that someone asked a couple of days ago in Las Cruces that kind of relates to this, and this is a huge question, but I think it does deserve to be asked. And that question is this. Okay, so we're going vegan. Okay, that's good. Now, but what about this? Capitalism. We live in a capitalist society, which is based on competition, and how does veganism relate to capitalism? So I think it's interesting. Like, I went on this kind of long thing talking about Jesus and the original disciples, and that they emphasized peace and nonviolence, as well as veganism and vegetarianism. Veganism, basically, and also communalism, not owning property. And personally, I wrote about in the World Peace Diet how animal agriculture is the foundation of capitalism, that the first capitalists were those who owned livestock. The proto-capitalist, capitalist means head, is the head of livestock. And so this whole idea of a wealthy elite emerging that owns the means of production of wealth. Livestock are basically the means of production of wealth, because if you own these animals, they are wealth by themselves. They are wealth in the sense that you can buy and sell them, like they're gold and silver. That's what they really were. They're wealth. They are worth money. You know, you can kill them and eat them, so they're actually practical on that level. You can milk them, you know, you can take their eggs if they're chickens or whatever, and you can, so they produce products that give you food, essentially. You can eat their flesh and so forth. It's all enormously violent, but that's basically it. They're wealth, but also you can breed them. I mean, think of it. You can impregnate them and do it much more rapidly. I mean, a cow in nature would never allow herself to be impregnated, you know, year after year after year after year. It would never happen. And so, but on a dairy or, you know, on any animal agriculture operation, large or small, that's what they do. They want to maximize their wealth, maximize their production, so you breed these animals and much more than they ever would be, and by breeding them, you increase your wealth. So this is how capitalism started, essentially, was through owning animals and breeding them, and these were the meat. This was the, you know, capitalism is where people who are capitalists not only own wealth, but they own the means of creating wealth, and then they hire people and so forth. But the idea is that animal agriculture is the prototype of that, and this system spread. And then I talk about it in the World Peace Diet too, how the whole idea of creating corporations are legal institutions, fabrications really, that allow the capitalists who are using their money and controlling the means of production to evade responsibility for their actions, so that they are no longer liable, they are no longer personally responsible, the corporation is responsible, but the corporation is not a being. But of course now it is a being, it's a legal being in our world. And so we have a situation, basically because of eating meat and dairy, we've created a system of competition that basically allows a small wealthy elite to control most of the wealth, and especially through corporations and large financial institutions now. This is what's happening. So, you know, the question is, so can we possibly transition to a benevolent, peaceful, vegan, sustainable world as long as we have capitalism, which is based on essentially dominating animals? And I would say probably not. I don't think capitalism and peace and happiness really go together. So I think we're going to see more and more movements away from capitalism. Either the capitalist system that we see, the corporate capitalistic system that's become extremely corrupt and violent, is going to crash, and then but there's grassroots movements all over the place that will be more sustainable. We do see, for example, the Mondragon communities in Spain, as they continue to grow and prosper. These are completely worker-owned companies and collectives that are not capitalist. So they're worker-owned, and they're extremely successful. I mean, probably the most successful enterprises in Spain, you know, this entire country. And they're not completely non-capitalist. So I think, you know, in that sense, there'll be more and more cooperatives, either, owner, like REI is sort of a, you know, consumer-owned, which I think is a step in the right direction. Models like Mondragon, which are worker-owned, I think are, there's quite a few worker-owned smaller operations in the United States. We get our tortillas from Alvarado Street Bakery, which is a worker-owned cooperative. But I think, you know, we'll see movements in that direction. We're seeing movements for alternative currencies. We're seeing movements for more just communal ways of living, growing our own, I think just growing our own food, doing the best we can to find a niche where we're living, where we're, as best we can, living a life of right livelihood. And I think the more we can do business with other vegans and do it in a way that's cooperative and sustainable, the better. You know, so, but the system itself, it's difficult. Obviously, we're born into it. It's very powerful. We've got powerful governmental and financial institutions that enforce and taxes and currencies and regulations and legal obligations of all kinds on us, so that makes it somewhat difficult to change these. But I think as we more and more people go vegan, there will be just the consciousness will change, and as the consciousness changes, then the institutions will change as well. And of course, as we change the institutions, that will also help the consciousness to change, because right now we're, you know, of course, subsidizing the meat, dairy, egg industry and the banking industry and the large corporations and the energy, huge coal, oil industry. We're subsidizing all of them so much, and the pharmaceutical industry, all of that. But as we go vegan, I think more and more people do, there'll be more and more questioning of that. You know, I just read an article yesterday, actually, that I think moves in that direction quite a bit, because we saw that there was, I may have this article in here on the list, the USDA now has finally starting to move toward toward recommendations that really reduce meat, dairy, and egg consumption, and they're doing it less for nutritional reasons and more for environmental reasons. Yeah, the article, it's right at the beginning of the second page of the resources. An article from the Washington Post: meat industry's worst nightmare could soon become a reality. Yeah, the meat industry's worst nightmare is that the USDA is going to start really promoting plant-based eating and is criticizing the meat industry. Of course, it seems hard for that to happen since the USDA is pretty much made up of people from the meat and dairy industries. It's a revolving door. But it's getting more and more obvious, really. It's so obvious now that the meat and dairy industries are utterly destroying the watersheds and just the environmental death toll and global warming, all these things, climate change. So it's just harder and harder for them to justify recommending people eating a lot of animal foods. And there's a great graph in the story that shows the environmental impact of various foods, both animal-based foods and plant-based foods, and just all the obviously all the most environmentally devastating foods are all animal-based foods. The worst of all is lamb. I don't remember all of them, but it goes lamb and then beef and then cheese and then pork and then factory farm salmon and then other things all the way down, you know, chickens, various things. And then when you get to lentils and, you know, beans and wheat, it's just a tiny, tiny fraction. So the things that are really devastating our planet are all animal-based foods, and that's well known. It's absolutely irrefutable, you know, and so how can the USDA do anything but try to educate people? So the whole idea, and the other idea that I've started to emphasize, too, that I think goes along with this is the idea of secondhand eating. Do you know, you all know what I mean by secondhand eating? Now, this is a good point to bring up with people, I think, too. Secondhand, basically smoking, went for decades and decades and decades, and no one could make any progress in trying to get it reduced or get it slowed down or stopped or get people to stop smoking. And then when it was discovered, finally, that when someone smokes, they're not just hurting themselves. Anyone who's in the area who breathes in that secondhand smoke is being harmed as much as or perhaps worse than the smoker. And then they discovered something called third-hand smoke, which is also devastating, which is this when the smoke gets into just draperies and things. And you go into the room later, and you're breathing in these toxins from smoke. So the discovery of second-hand and third-hand smoking really started this whole huge wave of legislation banning people from smoking anywhere, in public places, and get the whole medical industry to condemn, Surgeon General to warn, all these things, and really reducing the rates of smoking in the United States enormously, actually. And, of course, the corporations go to other countries to try to, you know, capitalize there. But we see the impact of this, and I think it's the same thing is inevitable with secondhand eating. You know, right now people think that they can eat meat and dairy and eggs, and it's just a personal choice. And it's becoming clear that it's absolutely not a personal choice. It's a choice. Besides the terrible violence towards animals, some people could say, well, they don't matter. But you know, obviously, the terrible violence towards animals and wildlife and so forth and ecosystems. But from the point of view of secondhand eating, someone who's eating meat and dairy is destroying as a non-meat eater, as a vegan, chances to live a healthy life, and taking all this water out of the aquifers, causing all this pollution, just cutting down the rainforest, causing global climate destabilization, causing my children to probably not have a world to live in. So this is secondhand eating. It's absolutely immoral and absolutely unacceptable for people to eat meat and dairy at this point when we know this, that there have to be laws passed to tax this, to limit this, to stop this behavior that's devastating to everyone, just as we do with smoking. I think the momentum for this is really building. I've been talking about this, actually, that 2015, I think, could be the year where we see major changes happening in the way we're living because of the secondhand eating idea. This is not just like smoking, just something that only hurts oneself. Somebody say, well, I want to get a heart attack, I'll have a burger, I'll have a, you know, that's my business, you know. Yeah, it's not. I mean, first of all, they force everybody to wear seatbelts because we all have to pay for insurance and higher premiums for sick people or people who are injured. And it's the same thing, obviously, with eating meat and dairy. But beyond that, the devastation to the earth and on every level, the devastation. So I think the more that we can begin to just do whatever we can to bring this to help people understand this and remind people of this, the better. All right, so I'm going to take a break here. It's 9:15. I know we have Lily is on the line, and I would love to hear Lily. Lily, I'm going to unmute your phone. I hope you're still there. I wanted to hear a little bit. I know you've started up your second round of the World Peace Diet Sundays, and some people on the call are, I'm sure, aware of this, but I was just wondering if you could maybe say a few words about the World Peace Diet Sunday and how it's been going, and just love to hear your voice and hear you, what you have to say about this. And also, anyone else who'd like to say something, we've only got 15 minutes left here. I apologize for kind of monopolizing things, but I didn't see any questions coming in. So hi. Go ahead, Lily, you're on.
Oh, hi, you Will. Oh,
hi.
Please monopolize. That's why we're here.
Right.
That's why we're all together, to hear what you have to say. And we can hear it again and again and again. Thank you so much for mentioning the World Peace Diet Sunday. It was very interesting last week. At the top of the hour, as soon as we say compassion encircles the earth for all beings everywhere, I ask if there are any new people on the line. Well, last week, 7 new people came, which was delightful. And then this week, we had an interesting couple, and I think you know them. They had set their clocks for 2:45 in a tent in South Africa so that they wouldn't miss a minute of the World Peace Diet Study Group.
Wow.
And I was so impressed with that. They were delightful. I would like to have them come and speak. They're on a World Peace bike tour and handing out your CDs. Do you know about this? Do you know about them?
Handing out the CDs?
Of you reading the World Peace Diet.
No, I don't think so.
Really?
Can you say a little more? Yeah, I mean...
I can give you their names, and they were just—they were a delight. And in fact, when their alarm clock went off at 2:45, one of them said, "Well, maybe we ought to sleep in." The other one said, "No, we've made a commitment to go to this, and we're going."
Wow!
And I don't even know how they managed to do it in a tent in South Africa. They're on this bike tour, but they were so enthusiastic about finding this vegan community on a telephone, you know, on a telephone conference call,
right,
that they
right,
could
right,
tap
right.
into weekly. And I'm hoping that they'll get the idea of maybe putting one on in their own time zone. That would be the ideal thing to do, you know.
People love it.
I would highly recommend
that. Incredible.
That people.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. Their names were. I have it written down here.
Yeah, you know what? I do remember now.
Andy and
yes.
Sven. Andy.
Right,
and
right, right.
Sven.
Yeah, they have emailed me a couple of times and told me that they're. But I think once they took off, I haven't heard from them in a while, but they did tell me that they're doing this. Yes, I'm aware of it now.
Yeah, and they were right. They loved reading the World Peace Diet in community. And of course, I read
great.
A lot of it myself, and I
yeah.
also have people coming in and reading it, but also discussing it as we go along. And every chapter is kind of illuminated with our own experience. Which is
right.
great, because sometimes it's the only chance a person will have to get the message. And many
right.
people don't want to read it alone. You know, they're afraid to. So it
right.
kind of makes it okay, you know, to read it in community like this. And I highly recommend that anyone
yeah.
listening to this group tonight, would come and hear the gala that took place on the 14th of December, after 14 months of nonstop reading the World Peace Diet, week after week,
right.
for, you know,
right, right.
week after week, we never missed a week. It's wonderful. I have some steady members who come, and they're very committed to it. But all
yes.
those people bring new people, and some of those people. One person called me this week and said, I finally made it to your study group. You invited me when you first had the idea of having this. I finally made it. So you never
oh.
know. You never know. And people become vegan from this. They become vegan activists, and it's a great way to plug people in, because I really give a lot of thought to what we're reading. You know, each week I study it carefully, because I kind of figured out, you know, where we're going to go and how quickly we'll go. And it may not take 14 months. When I first read The World Peace Diet, I told you this, Will. I said, I think it's something that should be read very slowly and pondered and discussed as we go along. And that's what we're doing on it. It's a wonderful way. A lot of people have said, oh, I feel like a lonely vegan. I don't feel lonely anymore.
Yes. Yeah. That's really important. I think to have an opportunity to read The World Peace Diet in a community and to share both the pain and the insights that come from that, and the sense of outrage sometimes, like, oh, how can this be happening? And then the sense of the tremendous possibilities we have. You know, community really is where it's at, I think, because it's what actually causes us to eat meat, and I think it's where we're going to come out of and creating new communities. And I don't know if everybody's aware, a lot of you are, I think, but Lily started this about, I think it was in October of 2013, am I right? And you went all the way through to the end of, basically wrapped it up in December of 2014. One reading of 14 took 14 months with people as a community. It was your idea after quite a few years of pondering how you could make a contribution to help bring the vegan message to the world, and you don't have access to the internet where you live way out in the dirt road in northern California. And but with your experience in phone bridges and so forth through 12-step programs and other kinds of things, you thought, well, I'm going to try something as an experiment, and here it is. You went through an entire reading of the World Peace Diet with many people coming and going and staying and so forth, and now just on January 4th, right, you started right up with the preface, and you're beginning again, and I just think it's enormously inspiring to see this going on, and I've been mentioning it on the lecture tours too, and I'm hoping that people will see this as a really valid way to read the World Peace Diet. One of the things I've noticed over the years when I've talked to people is that some people kind of spontaneously do it. You know, they'll, like a husband and wife will read it to each other together, or two friends will get together on the phone and read it to each other. I've noticed that. And I've noticed that when they do that, they seem to have a superior experience of it. I mean, like these two women in Cincinnati, I think one of them had a difficulty reading for some reason, so the other woman would just read it to her. And they both, you know, would call me and they would order like 10 or 20 copies to give to everybody. You know, they said, we read it to each other on the phone. It's just the greatest thing. You know, we want to get everybody to read it. I think
well,
there's something
I, well,
about
invite
that,
them
you know,
to come to
together,
our
you know?
Study group. That would be great, you know.
Right.
That's really what the study group is doing. My husband originally read it to me. While I was fixing, every night he read a little bit to me, and by chapter 3, as you know, the story, I turned to him and I said, we're vegan, aren't we? And he goes, yeah, we're vegan. And that was it. I mean, that happened 8 years ago now, and we hadn't planned to become vegan. But see, it's one thing to put out the vegan message, but it's another thing to put out the World Peace Diet message, and that is so inclusive, that is such a well-cut diamond that Donald Watson, I've been saying this, I think he considered it to be the vegan Bible. So I feel like, you know, we're coming together for a Bible study here across the United States and all the way to South Africa, because it really does include so many reasons to be vegan. A woman called today, she said, tell me about the food you're eating. Tell me about this. And I said, well, do you have a reason to become vegan? And she said, well, I don't really know. And I said, I immediately put her in the mindset of the World Peace Diet and invited her immediately to come to our phone bridge, because that way she can get a feeling of it, a feeling for why. There has to be a why. And if it's just health, any floating health cure is going to get your attention, even if they tell you to eat meat three times a day, if it's just health. It's got
right.
to be a deep level of compassion, and it's got to be. That's really the only reason to really go deeply vegan. The environment, I was an environmentalist. I loved animals. I didn't go vegan until my heart was open with the compassionate words of the World Peace
right.
Diet. It permeates every page. And so, therefore, when I teach the World Peace Diet, I teach it with that feeling in mind, that deep, deep, abiding compassion that just glows in every page. I'm on my sixth reading of this book now. I read it four times before I started the study group and once with the study group, and this is the sixth reading, and it's not the kind of book that you can ever get enough of. There's so
right.
much in it,
right.
Will.
Right.
There's so much in it. You ought to read it. It's
yeah.
a great read.
Yes. You know, it's...
World Peace Diet banger, I'll tell you. I am. I mean, this is it. This is the final, this is the beginning and the end of why to go vegan. And once you have a strong, solid why, you'll never be anything but. I know there's a gal on the line tonight. She said, I could never go back now that I've read the World Peace Diet. She became vegan on the World Peace Diet and is now a vegan activist on the World Peace Diet study group. So I invite people, anyone can, you know, you can send people
right.
over, and even if they only come one time, they're going to be touched. They're going to be touched
right.
by it because it's your words, but it's your words in community.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think, you know, if anyone... If you know anyone who would like to read the World Peace Diet, maybe you give the book to somebody. I think it's really just great to mention the possibility that they might want to listen in on Sunday evening to the reading that's ongoing. And I'll just give it out here just so everybody knows. I have it actually just to tell you it's at the top of. If you go to worldpeacedite.com and just go to the upcoming events where we have our huge schedule, which is right now unusually huge because we're doing events. I was just going over it with Madeline almost every single night for the next 2 months. But at the very top is ongoing World Peace Diet Sundays, facilitated by Lily Macy, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time every Sunday. The number to call, and it has the number 712-432-3900, and the code is 568364. Pound, and it goes for an hour, and then usually I think you stay on longer, right, for another
that's kind of an open session.
If
yeah,
people want
a,
to, but,
it's
but the
a,
actual
it's
event a, is an hour. Yeah,
we have the originator of Evolution Diet, pet food, who's been around now for over 25 years, and he answers a lot of pet food concerns.
Right.
Because my pets have all been on his pet food now for 8 years, and as soon as I became vegan, I knew that I would not feeding my pets these tortured animals. So I immediately found Eric Wiseman's company, Evolution Pet Food, and
right.
He comes on and answers all kinds of pet food questions and pet questions after we study.
We don't
do any of that during that first hour. But after,
yeah.
other people can bring things in that they've heard, recipes, trade emails, phone numbers, whatever they want, because what we're trying to
yeah.
do is create vegan community. And I think that's what our South African friends saw, and they were
right.
they
yes.
were glad they got up. They stayed for the whole World Peace Diet study group, which is an hour, and then they stayed all the way to the end, which actually went on another hour. That it was, you know, yeah. people were and they wound up putting their tape or their telephone outside so that we could all hear the birds in Africa together.
God.
I mean, it was so sweet. They
yeah.
were creating this energy field that you talk about.
Right.
And we were just
yeah.
crossing over with each other, and they said they were energized, and why wouldn't they be? And we read such a beautiful section last week, and we're still on chapter one, but I do believe we may complete it this week. I'm not sure. I'm not racing
right.
through it. We're just taking our time and in savoring it, and really savoring
yeah.
what this is. It's the most important book I've ever read in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I've dedicated my life to it.
Right. And I think the idea also that you mentioned is an important one too, the idea that the World Peace Diet is really intended not just, because it's been really great actually since we went on this tour, just last night, you know, twice or three times, I guess, we had a little, like a vegan meal beforehand, and people came up to me and they said, you know, I came to your lecture, and you were here 4 years ago, and I read your book, and I gave up meat and gave up dairy. I became a vegan after reading your book, and I think that's one thing that reading the World Peace Diet can do, and it does quite a bit, I think, to help people to become vegan. But the other thing you mentioned, which I think is also very important, is it helps move people who are already vegan to actually decide or feel inspired to begin to bring this message to other people more proactively. And I think this is really an important step for anyone who, you know, to not to just go vegan and say, that's it, I did enough. I mean, it's great to go vegan, but to actually begin to arrange our lives so that we're bringing this message as best we can to other people and find our unique way of contributing to the vegan movement. Because I think that's when we start to really see enormous changes. I think positive changes in our own lives, too, come from this as well.
Oh, I'll tell you, there's been a lot. I was antsy. I wanted something that I could do way out here in the boonies. Like, you know, if I had internet, which maybe eventually I'll have, I could write a blog or whatever. But I felt that this voice-to-voice contact and voices speaking to other voices about this and about the World Peace Diet just seemed so satisfying to me. And to create a vegan community over the phone lines. I love it. And I have that community now. I looked for a vegan community of people I can call up anytime I want and just talk vegan to them because it's a different language. And we talk vegan together. And I love it.
Right. Yeah. Beautiful. Well, thank you, Lily. It's actually, we're at our time.
Thanks for calling on me, Will.
It's 10:30 already. So I'm going to begin the wrap-up. Thanks, Lily.
Thank you. Stay well. We're with you in spirit.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay, so I'm going to begin to wrap it up. I did see, I did get an email, a couple emails from various, from Susan. I mentioned earlier from Sedona, and she wanted to kind of specifically say that the question that people have is that they, these so-called spiritual people who say it's fine to eat animals, is that they, that they feel that they have gotten permission from the animals, that the animals say it's okay to eat them. Oh, okay, well, you know, right. So, you know, obviously, I think the best thing to do in all situations is to listen to people, to respond to them, not in an argumentative way, but to have a sense of, yeah, you know, I understand that. You know, I used to think the same thing, you know. Yeah, the animals really give themselves. You know, there's a sense, I understand that, you know, that certain, you know, that maybe in the wild, if a deer is being going to be pounced upon by a lion, that there's a certain moment when the deer just yields and says, okay, you know, there's a sense of this larger life knowing and all of that. The thing is, we humans would like to take this kind of sense of entitlement, a sense of liberty, not liberty, but a sense of, of course, hunting is already causing enormous distress and violence to animals, but herding is a whole other thing. Herding is actually imprisoning these animals their entire lives, mutilating their bodies, stealing their babies, killing them. I mean, there's just, and this argument is absurd, and of course it was already used. I think it would be good to, you know, if it was me, I would be saying something like, you know, I realized that this was the same thing, of course, that white people said about black people, that they, you know, that they like this, it's, you know, this is mutually beneficial, and it's always the dominator that's saying that kind of thing, but say, you know, then I realized that this is actually just a socially injected rationalization And then let go. Just plant the seed and let go. That's one of the most important things, I think, because we cannot change other people. We'd love to be able to step in there and just change people. And that's why they resist. And so they'll come up with anything to resist. So to make a heart connection with people when we're talking to them, to listen to them, and then to simply do the best we can to plant a seed using statements about myself, what I've discovered, and then let it go. You've planted the seed and move on to something else and plant seeds. And there'll be some people that will be enormously resistant, and it can be very frustrating in a sense if you want them to change and they don't. But just plant the seeds, because everyone's going to ripen in their own time. And that's really how it is. There's so many people, I think, who are closer to ripening, and it's good to spend time with those kinds of people who listen to what we say, and I think who will move and become vegan, and we can get very somewhat frustrated, I guess is the word, if we keep trying to be effective vegan advocates with people who really passionately resist us. So I think it's good to be smart in our activism and use our energy where the openings are, and we'll be able to move more and more people that way. It's very important to do that. Even people who are close to us, you know, even if they're our friends and family, you know, if they're really not interested, work with people, you know, young people, college people, or whoever it is who are open to this, and I think we'll find not only we'll feel a lot better, but we'll be actually seeing more results. But the most important thing is, as the Bhagavad Gita says, don't be attached to the fruits of your actions. Just do the best we can to embody and live what veganism is, and then let go. So I want to, again, thank all of you for joining us. I don't know where the time went, but I do want to also mention, please have a look at the resources. I want to really thank Marlene Narrow in Massachusetts. She's now pioneering her own vegan radio show. This is so exciting. Thank you, Marlene. And I was, I think, the first person she interviewed on this new show. It's called Vegan Nation. She's in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's a longtime vegan and World Peace Diet facilitator. She helped to put on a number of things, a lecture we did in Worcester a while back. You can go online to WCUW. There, you can see it on your resources. You can listen there. And Madeline is also interviewed. I think hers will be coming out in a few weeks. We also have a number of wonderful things happening by World Peace Diet facilitators. Pamela Zeman, who's up in the Seattle area, is doing a lot of work with videos and online work. And I will be actually being interviewed by her, I think, next month in early February for a whole series that she's doing. Of course, Kip Anderson, who's a World Peace Diet facilitator and the creator of Cowspiracy, been doing some great stuff, not only with Cowspiracy, but with Taking Action for Wild Horses, who are being devastated in the West. Veronique, of course, is doing a lot of work. She's back in France now and has her own blog and website and coaching, vegan coaching practice and so forth. And Susan Pitcairn, of course, is doing a lot of work now in Sedona, showing films. And we can go through this. There's quite a few people. Jerry in Japan has got this recipes that he's put up online. Some great articles, Ranchers with the Real Eco Terrorists. Boy, I tell you, this is really starting to come out. I think more and more we're seeing progress being made. So I want to thank all of you. I'll close with this quote by Cesar Chavez. Only when we have become nonviolent towards all life will we have learned how to live well with others. And the final saying by Margaret Mead. Never depend upon institutions or government to solve any problem. All social movements are founded by, guided by, motivated, and seen through by the passion of individuals. And individuals and community is the most powerful of all. So we'll be having our next gathering online in February, as Madeline and I continue traveling. If you're anywhere near, if you know people in the southern states of the United States, we'll be coming through and giving lectures all over the place. The third Thursday of February is the 19th, so we'll be doing our call there from somewhere between Dallas and Tucson. And so we look forward to to your participation then. And until then, we, Mel and I both together, are deeply grateful for your presence in our lives, for your commitment to being the change, as Gandhi said, that we would like to see in the world, and to bringing the vegan, Gopicide vegan and the vegan message to more and more people close to us, and to communities, and to even people all over, even in South Africa. I mean, it's true. This is going global. The World Peace Diet now, we just found out, has been picked up in Russian. It's got a contract to publish in Russian. And so this is part of a global movement. We send our love. We hold you in the light. And we'll go forth with some music. This is the piece called The Joy of Sky. Much love to you all. Thank you again for joining us.